Good evening, friends.
Good evening.
Is anybody here for the very first time? But we all are beginners, so we're all here for the first time. Yeah, welcome everybody. My name is Patrice. I'm a longtime student here. And thank you, Kokyo, for inviting me to give a talk tonight. And I'd like to express my gratitude to my root teacher, Catherine Thanis. It's always humbling and a little bit intimidating to sit in her seat. So, when I arrived at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center this summer to do a work practice stay, I took my bags and put them in the, you know, they have the carts that you wheel around in there and lugged it all the way down to the upper barn. I moved into my room and found that the former occupant of my room had left a gift for me. And I was very excited because it was a gift that I was very much hoping would be in the room because I didn't bring one and I really wanted one. And it was a wall calendar. And a beautiful wall calendar, the Suzuki Roshi calendar, which for every month has Suzuki Roshi, probably everybody or most people know, is the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, Nuff Tassajara. And so every month of this calendar has a beautiful artwork, some sort of Buddhist artwork, and a quote or some type of an inscription, calligraphy, a saying. So the first thing I noticed about this calendar was that the former resident had been very diligent about drawing a large X through every single day that was preceding. And I was like, should I look at June? You know, and I did all X's. May, all X's. I couldn't look past April. I was starting to get nervous. It's sort of the time-honored tradition, you know, people keeping time everywhere. Marking the passage of conventional time. But even more impressive than the X's in the artwork and the fact that I received this beautiful gift was the quote from Suzuki Roshi on July. And the quote was, "Our practice is to go beyond the realm of good and bad and to realize the absolute." Our practice is to go beyond the realm of good and bad and to realize the absolute. And it was a quote that just sort of washed over me like a little waterfall, and I experienced simultaneously to be deeply inspiring and deeply challenging. Because the realm of good and bad is where I hang out. So I thought, well, there really could be an entire lifetime study distilled in that sentence. You know, when we're making judgments about good and bad all the time, it's sort of closely related to also what we sometimes call right and wrong. And we're always judging. Many times we're just doing it automatically, whether something is harmful or helpful, whether it's necessary or unwanted, it could even be dangerous or if it's correct. And there's nothing wrong about making these sort of judgments or this reasoning. It's sort of fundamental and necessary to our lives. It's important for us to know if something we're taking into our mind and body to sort of anticipate the effect that might have on us could be harmful or beneficial, or to think about our actions in terms of promoting harmonious relationships or taking care of groups that we're involved in or even the planet. But it's a very messy realm. And sort of the duality, there's a duality inherent in good and bad that Suzuki Roshi talks about. I'll read you his full quote in a minute. And so it can be sort of inherently polarizing. And it can be related to conflict. It doesn't have to be, but it often is. And it can be conflict within ourselves, in our relationships, in our families. And there have been some indications that the tensions and divisions around what's best, what's correct, it's related to issues of national concern have been becoming increasingly polarized over the last 1 year and 24 hours. So, maybe somebody else has seen this, but last week the American Psychological Survey released a survey last week that they had done over a period of months called Stress in America. And so from the title, you can tell they wanted it to be sort of comprehensive, and it was. They had a huge sample of thousands of people, a very diverse sample, diverse by age, by gender, by culture and ethnicity, by economics. And in this huge sample, 6 out of 10 people said that current social divisiveness was a significant source of stress in their lives. And almost the same number of people, 59%, said that this is the lowest point in U.S. history that they can remember. And so, in this sample includes people who lived through World War II, Vietnam, September 11th, 2001. So, this realm of good and bad has sort of been heating up, at least it seems to me. And yet we can't escape this question of what is good, what's good, what's beneficial for ourselves, for the world, for all beings. That's our vow that we make. And Buddhism, we vow to embrace and sustain all beings. So here's Suzuki Roshi's expanded quote. And this was from the first night of a sesshin on September 1st, 1969 at Tassajara. He said, "Our everyday life is going on in the realm of good and bad, the realm of duality. And Buddha nature, or our absolute nature, is found in the realm of absolute, where there is no good or bad. Our practice is to go beyond the realm of good and bad and to realize the one absolute world. To enter the one absolute world is our practice." And then he helpfully adds, "It may be rather difficult to understand." D.T. Suzuki, another eminent Zen teacher, talks about duality in the world this way. "We have two eyes to see two sides of things, but there must be a third eye which will see everything at the same time and yet not see anything. That is to understand Zen." He does not add it may be difficult to understand, but just pretend that he did. All right. So, well, what does it mean to go beyond the realm of good and bad, and how can we practice this in the ordinary realm of good and bad? As we're making these decisions, judgments day to day, it's just a very sort of a natural process. We use our intellectual reasoning. We say, well, what do I think about? What do I think about this? We refer to our emotional reactions. How do I feel about this? Whatever it is that gives us information. And we refer to our personal experience. What have I learned about these types of situations in my life? So you can see it's, at least from the realm of developmental psychology, this is all from the lens of the self, from the I, and it's bound by the causes and conditions of the self. So that whatever I might think or feel or promote about a certain idea or conflict or issue, it very much relates, it's not separate, it's inherently linked to my biology, my physiology, my family, my social experiences, my religious upbringing, but it's also related to my position of relative privilege in the world and the power that's granted to me or denied related to my position of relative privilege. So this might have to do with my skin color, my cultural background, gender, sexual orientation, my economic privilege, educational privileges, ability, my immigration status. All of these things are factoring into our viewpoint and our judgments, and yet they're all very much in the realm of this world of duality. So to sort of go beyond good and bad, to enter the absolute world, one recommendation that we have from our Zen founder, Dogen, founder of Soto Zen, is to study the self. If we can become more intimate with our self-centric, our ego-centered perspective, he says in Genjo Koan, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awakened by myriad things. And he's not saying, you know, to study the self is to forget the self. It's not a process of somehow negating or nullifying or resisting our ordinary mind. It just sort of becomes less the center of things in this framework. It's a process of adopting also perhaps what we sometimes call right view in the Noble Eightfold Path that the Buddha talks about. Reb Anderson says that when we talk about right view or the Eightfold Path, right speech, right mindfulness, right livelihood, he says that Buddha is using right in the sense of complete or comprehensive, not in the sense of right versus wrong. To study the self. Reb Anderson also in his book, Being Upright, says about this study of the self, by admitting and being mindful of selfishness, selflessness, and truth-speaking can spontaneously arise. Freedom from selfishness does not come from pretending that we are not selfish. It is realized through the complete study of our selfishness. The complete study. And I, you know, that study has to be done with kindness, with a deep respect and sensitivity and compassion for these fixed views and opinions that we hold. They are often, they often occur with very strong emotional reactions, and by studying these emotional reactions, we can learn about why we're reacting so strongly. In my own case, usually, I found that, you know, I'm having some type of a, I call it a self-emergency. Something that sort of, you know, something that sort of survival intensity. I have to defend myself in some way or stand up for the self in some way. I like my fixed views. They give me some sense of self-definition, of identity, of clarity and constancy, predictability. So studying the self. One thing I have, a couple little practices I've adopted from studying the self is, I love to expound on whatever my opinion might be and, you know, bring in all the various sources and everything for why I have such a great opinion. But then at the end I might, I'll probably just add on, maybe. So that sort of just takes some of the juice out of the whole thing. The other thing I do is I just to see the absurdity in it. I had I retired a couple months ago, but before I did that, I had a staff meeting every Tuesday in the health center on campus at Student Services, and then I would have to walk about 25 minutes to my office from that meeting. And in this staff meeting, many painful decisions were made, none of which I have power over, any of them, or even influence. And all of which I had many derogatory judgments about. So all the way back to my office, I would say to myself, my way is the best way. My way is just better, and it's just the best way. And I'd repeat this over and over until I would just burst out. By the time I reached my office, I would just be laughing at the whole, yeah. And the funny thing is, I still believed my way was the best way. But, you know, somehow I didn't have to act it out in any harmful way if I could just laugh at it. Anyway, studying the self, one prescription for going beyond good and bad. But entering the absolute world, this is our practice of Zazen, the absolute world, undivided true reality, ultimate truth, the source. Zazen, Dogen says in the Jiji Uzumai, which we chant here at the Zendo, The zazen of even one person at one moment imperceptibly accords with all things and fully resonates through all time. Each moment of zazen is equally wholeness of practice, equally wholeness of realization. This is not only practice while sitting, it is like a hammer striking emptiness. Before and after, its exquisite peal permeates everywhere. How can it be limited to this moment? In the same Jiji Uzumai, Dogen uses the phrase unconstructedness in stillness. This is an all-inclusive enlightenment, nothing left out. In this present moment, Thich Nhat Hanh has a teaching that says, this present moment, likes to say, this is where time touches eternity. This present moment. Another teaching about the absolute. As we practice Zazen, we're over and over again cultivating a stability in this present moment. A stability of body and mind, illuminating the true present in an undivided reality, a reality that doesn't have artificial and shifting moments of, I have moments, but strong dividing lines of good and bad. Hong Shur, in his book, Cultivating the Empty Field, says, the practice of true reality is simply to sit serenely in silent introspection. When you have fathomed this, you cannot be turned around by external causes and conditions. This empty, wide, open mind is subtly and correctly illuminating, spacious and content, without confusion from inner thoughts of grasping. Spacious and content, without confusion from inner thoughts of grasping, effectively overcome habitual behavior and realize the self that is not possessed by emotions. It's a more expansive awareness. Again, in the Jiji Uzumai, Dogen says, you immediately leap beyond the boundary of awakening. At this moment, you turn the unsurpassably great Dharma wheel and expound the profound wisdom, ultimate and unconditioned. The absolute, ultimate and unconditioned. So, although we can practice, we can study the self, we can practice Zazen, we can use these practices to help us go beyond good and bad, to enter the absolute. But realizing the absolute or entering the absolute is not something we do. In the song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, our ancestor Dongshan refers to entering the absolute as wondrously embraced within the real. Drumming and singing begin together. And Taigen, Dan Layton, one of our renowned Zen scholars, contemporary Zen scholars, has this book, Just This Is It. He's talking about the teachings of Dongshan, including the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, and he says about this phrase, wondrously embraced within the real, drumming and singing begin together. He says, something is wondrously, mysteriously, subtly, exquisitely, and beautifully embraced within the real, within the ultimate, perfect, upright truth. When that happens, arising together, there emerges a pair that can be translated as drumming and singing. This refers to instant, unmediated inquiry and response, or literally, hitting and yelling back. So you can see he's describing this as something spontaneous, organic, creative, intuitively, something that's emergent, not something that we're constructing or putting together or doing. In this book, it's called Dongshan, the practice of suchness. A suchness being another way to think about, another way to talk about this present reality, ultimate truth, the source, the absolute. And so he says, suchness responds to sincere inquiry without any mediation through analysis or deliberation. And so we're not really using our process of cognitive discernment here. In such an embracing situation, no separation comes between call and response, between the universal ineffable reality and conditioned phenomena as its manifest expression in this present situation. No separation comes between the absolute and the conditioned phenomenal reality as we judge right and wrong, manifest expression in this current situation. So it's an all-inclusive, undivided activity. And he takes pains to, Taigen takes pains to illuminate this translation as referring to a process that involves cherishing something precious, a dear precious treasure, he calls it, deep intimacy with the whole process of practice. Susan McConnell from San Francisco Zen Center, when she was here a month or so ago, talked about the phrase imperceptible mutual assistance, something that arises when causes and conditions accord. I have an image on my, a photograph on my refrigerator that I like to look at every day that reminds me of this. It's of a place called Thor's Well. Has anyone heard of Thor's Well? It's not from the comic. There's a place in the ocean off the central coast of Oregon, off Yahats, Oregon, that is sort of a restless, turbulent, extensive to the horizon patch of sea. And there's a formation, a circular formation that is quite large, and it has a little, some few rocky outcroppings on it, not too big. It's sort of a sinkhole or depression where the sea from all directions rushes into this well without ceasing. It never fills up, but never stops, just unending. I don't know how long this formation has been there, but it's been a long time, years. Endlessly, the water rushing into the sea. And so it appears, you know, bottomless. And so at some point, somewhere beneath, the water must return necessarily to the broader ocean surroundings. And I love this as an image of undivided and all-inclusive activity, the well receiving endlessly and giving simultaneously, endlessly, the ocean giving without end and also receiving back endlessly, and the water itself, the gift that's not separate at all from the ocean, from the well. And, you know, it calls to mind the phrase we say in Zen, if no giver, no receiver, no gift. So I think from this process, this drumming and singing, this undivided activity that's able to arise when we're practicing Zazen or when we're skillfully learning to see through some of our self-constructions, from this undivided activity, a truly awakened beneficial activity can arise, because it's not self-centric, it's not ego-centered, it's more trustworthy, it's creative, it's comprehensive response to whatever suffering and division is occurring, and as Taigen says, it's to be cherished, it's precious. It goes beyond the realm of good and bad. It arises in wholeness. And so it must be wholeness. So I'll tell you a little story. that happened to me about 6 months ago. I was still working, and I had a daily commute that was up and down the bike path of the west side of campus. Some of you might know it. It's about a 35-minute hike up and down through beautiful meadows and really beautiful place to prepare for work and to decompress from work on the way home. And one day in the spring, I was walking down the bike path, and I think I had a pretty hard day. And so my walk home was often sort of a refuge for me, where I could feel free of some of the incessant demands and decisions and responsibilities of my work, which was, you know, I think I'd had a very I was working as a psychologist for student mental health, and every day I had a lot of responsibility for life and death. And here I was trying to decompress, and I'm walking, Liz knows this spot, sort of by the farm. There's a parking lot there. There's room for about just maybe 4 or 5 cars there. And I'm walking past, and I'm just breathing and relaxing, and I pass a truck and look at the bumper of this truck. And on the bumper, there's bumper stickers on this truck that just sort of like hit me like a physical, almost like a physical force. There's the naked, stylized cartoon torso of a woman, no arms or legs or head, or just featuring very large breasts. And next to the cartoon torso is a stylized head of a male figure featuring very prominent eyes and a tongue that's hanging out and drooling at the torso. That's about as offensive as, you know, you could imagine. My description barely does it justice, but... And anyways, okay, so nothing about this was okay with me. Nothing about this was okay. It was very triggering. And immediately all of my judgments started to arise about the driver of this truck or the owner of this truck, if not the driver, and how wrong and bad and offensive and everything else this is. And, you know, so I just sort of watched what was happening for me, and I've learned that I very quickly go to this state of sort of righteous indignation. Like, this is just really wrong, and I need to do something about it. And it's, you know, usually what occurs to me is I need to lash out in some way, or I need to act. And, you know, I've learned over the years that this is sort of it's a response that comes from many things, is most deeply from traumatic sorts of emotionally traumatic situations where I had to fight back in some way in order, and that was my only option, maybe because I was so young, to protect myself, to protect my emotional self or my child self. So back in the day, we used to have these stickers in the 70s that you could carry around with you. The sticker said, "This promotes violence against women," and you could just stick it on whatever. I didn't have any of those, but I thought, I wish I had some of those stickers, but I didn't. So here I am, I'm like, what am I going to do? And I made the decision right away that I didn't want to just push back, because that's my instinct. I felt pushed, and I wanted to push back. I felt hurt, and I wanted to hurt back. I felt offended, and I wanted to insult back. So I decided to write a letter. Right there, I had my bag with me from work, a legal pad and a pen, and I stood over sort of away from the area in case the person came out. I didn't want to confront the person without feeling ready to do that. So, and I just, you know, on one page, wrote down a letter, and I set some sort of guardrails for myself on the letter. First of all, that I was going to completely honor and validate fully my own feelings about encountering this in what is usually a safe place for me. And also, while recognizing that this person, whoever they are, really is within their rights to express or display pretty much anything that they want to. So I made some guardrails that for myself and the guidelines in the letter that I was not going to attack or blame or shame or criticize or even judge this person in any way. And in addition to that, I have this sneaky thing I do where okay, I'm not attacking you or insulting you, but really I'm going to try and change your mind. I'm going to try and control or persuade or manipulate the person to my way of seeing things. And I said, I'm not going to do that. It's really, this is all, you know, an effort to impose my will on the person. So I wanted to leave room for something more spontaneous to come up. So I took pains to be very respectful. I didn't use any words like you should or you have to or you are. I used words like request and invite and suggest. And I just sort of, in one draft, wrote out a little bit about how, you know, the impact of seeing an image like this, that it's hurtful, it's very sort of demeaning, it can be threatening, especially if the person who sees it has had a traumatic experience with sexual harassment or sexual assault, and that there's something in the nature of it being sort of involuntary. You know, I didn't go looking for this image, that this image was experienced as sort of an intrusion, it had an impact of sort of was threatening in some way. So I know, just sort of explaining this. And I talked a little bit about some of the messages that I feel these images give to, say, to girls and women who have to see this, what this says to them about even young girls, or even like, you know, grandmothers who are driving up behind you at the red light, you know, what this is saying about their bodies and about their worth. And what it says also to little boys and men about what teaching is here about who and what women are and what women are for. There's a teaching in this, in your bumper sticker here. And I sort of, you know, an appeal to solidarity, just like, you know, I'm just to invite the person to, maybe I'm, you know, thinking about friends and cousins and sisters and mothers and grandmothers and aunts and nieces. I mean, just an appeal to solidarity, to not participate and these harmful messages that are so much a part of our everyday culture. And then I said, thank you very much for taking the time to read this. And I put it under the windshield wiper. And within minutes, I was completely free of it. That's how I knew that it was a complete and whole response, because it was done. I walked the rest of the way home. I maybe thought about it for a minute or two, but it was something that arose from a place of quiet rather than a place of agitation, so it allowed the agitation to move through. You know, I mean, I've had plenty of situations like this where I'm responding from agitation, and one thing that's characteristic of that I know about myself is that I can't let it go. I have to keep talking about it. I have to start texting about it. I have to take the photo and send the photo to someone and say, can you believe that I, you know. And none of that was happening. I didn't feel a need to process it in any way, mentally or emotionally. I don't even think, aside from tonight, this happened 6 months ago, I think I maybe mentioned it. I started to work on this talk, sort of to marinate about this talk a couple weeks ago, and I think I mentioned it to Dana. But I haven't really talked about it in the past 6 months or thought that much about it. Okay, so 2 days later, I'm walking down the bike path, la, la, la. Here comes the parking lot. There's the truck again. The day after, it wasn't there. The next day, it was there. I'm like, oh. I just didn't want to see it again. But I said to myself, you know, just deal with it. Just deal with wanting to turn away. And just walk and just go past it. And so I did, and of course I had to look, and the stickers were gone. And I was just sort of astonished. All the stickers were gone off the whole bumper. There were some other ones that were just like surfing and stuff. And I was just sort of astonished by this. And honestly, I didn't for a minute think that it was a result of my letter. I thought something happened. There was some alchemy that happened here. Some readiness and openness on all sides met together beyond good and bad. And that's what arose. So maybe we can, I guess, we have some time to have some conversation or some comments or questions about your own experiences with good and bad or anything else anybody would like to bring up. Joyce.
I have to say that in the context, there must have been some element of good and bad judgment that surrounded the parameters of that situation that made you in calmness and in equilibrium sense to be able to address it.
Well, I went through my whole... Do people hear Joyce is saying there must have been good and bad and to be able to address the situation in that context? I mean, I think there was at many levels, but the question is at what level do we engage it?
Yes.
And I think, you know, sort of my ordinary initial reaction was very strong about what was good and what was bad and about how I knew what was good. And that was bad. And I knew it. But if I engage from that level, what happens?
But the fact that you did not, it was choice, obviously, and you found within you the equanimity to remain calm, but the situation in and of itself required judgment.
Well, it perhaps required some judgment, but it also required an ability to practice.
Right, right. I fully...
And that, I think, is not a result of even me. Or it's a result of all the causes and conditions of my life, and that to enable a response to a situation like that to come from a deeper place, one has to, I think, engage this right view, right intention, comprehensive view, comprehensive intention, practicing in that way, practicing in the way of stillness and sort of letting the storm clouds go by.
Taking the backward step.
Arya?
It seemed to me, to respond to Joyce also, it seemed to me that it may not have been good and bad also that you were engaging with, but maybe like a sense of something that was causing suffering. And I think that's interesting. I don't think that's like completely like emptiness or anything, But I think you saw that was causing you really profound suffering, and you had like this kind of response that didn't seem so like ego-driven, but like very,
You know, what was interesting to me is I felt it was a very completely inclusive of suffering on all accounts. My own suffering, the suffering of whoever puts this on there, truck, the unconscious, maybe unintentional suffering that they're perpetuating. I mean, I don't think they're driving around trying to commit a hate crime necessarily, but, you know, maybe unconscious, their suffering. And the suffering of every person that, you know, encounters those images, and the suffering of everyone that's been injured by images that relate to sexism and sexual harassment and sexual assault. So I felt it was... that in my own little, I mean, I wasn't thinking this at the time, but sort of looking back on it, that it was a very sort of all-inclusive response to everybody's, just to suffering. Forget about everybody's suffering, but just to suffering.
May I also say, I wanted to thank you because I've often seen these stickers, and I think I have, like, I think my response is usually, like, this is kind of stupid, but maybe stupid, like, the more neutral side of things. I didn't realize like the and I would never. I mean, I would never think to do that. Ever have a sticker like that?
Yep.
But on the other hand, I also am not like so aware of how much suffering it seems to cause.
I
really appreciate that, you articulating that because I think sometimes there's these like blind spots about something neutral to one person that's deeply difficult.
Thank you for saying that, Arya. And I think that a lot of this is really coming to light now with all of the sort of this rapid onslaught of public dialogue about sexual harassment and the hashtag #MeToo and everybody sort of piling on, and not just women. And, you know, men as well saying this happened to me. And people starting to realize that there's a lot of suffering being caused every day. Mm-hmm. And that for some of us, I'll say it's more common to cisgender male people who were assigned male at birth, identify as male, sometimes are more protected. Sometimes women are protected too from the true impact of that suffering. If it ever happened to you or somebody you know. There was a great cartoon the other day. It was a Venn diagram. I think I saw it on Twitter. You know how Venn diagrams, often they're overlapping with the intersection. This one had no overlap. Just one circle that said, everybody who is shocked and cannot believe how pervasive and damaging these sexual harassment is in our culture. And the other circle said, women. So certainly something that factored into my response here was, I'll say, 6 decades of dealing with sexism. Yep.
Joyce? Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Do you think the absence of the stickers on that bumper sticker subsequently warranted maybe another note?
It could have. Yeah, it could have. I was just sort of shocked. Mm-hmm. And I think, but in a way, I didn't want to, because in a way, I didn't want to make it about me.
No, not about you, but in the greater scheme of things.
In a way, I didn't want to refer it back to me. I didn't want to.
Anonymous.
Well, I know, but still, it would make a link between the first note and the second note. And wow, I noticed this, and wow, you did a great job, or thanks for noticing, or I think there's probably a way to do it if somebody wanted to express gratitude or say, hey, you know, I noticed, and that's really. Whatever you could say, for me, it seemed like the most true. I'm not saying that it would be everybody's response,
right.
But for me, the most true response at that moment was to really just experience a profound gratitude and move on. And I don't even know. I mean, who knows? This could have been. It might not have even been. Might have been a truck somebody borrowed. Might have been a truck somebody just got, and they were like, "Oh man, I got to get rid of those stickers. Like, well, maybe I'll have time this weekend." Who knows what the story behind that was? But I guess for whatever reason, I think, you know, there would have been a perfectly fine response, but it didn't, you know, come up for me in that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kathy Toldy.
One of the things I'm really appreciating about your talk and story, and I'm remembering another story you told that was similar.
God, because this happens to me all the time.
It was like you were driving a car and you had an encounter with somebody. Mm-hmm. And again, you found a way that was like a potential road rage encounter. And you found a way to humanize it so that it didn't turn in, it didn't escalate. So I was just appreciating. But particularly, what I'm thinking is, you know, one of the things a lot of times I hear people struggle with is, you know, if we're really trying to practice the Buddha way, and if we're really trying to be beyond good and bad and non-dual, does that mean then that we become these people who don't have strong feelings?
That's right.
Who don't have preferences?
That's right.
And I'm loving how you're just confessing, you know, with humor. Yeah, you do like to be right. You do believe in right and wrong. And
I do.
You've got all that. And yet, you make this deep, deep effort to true yourself up, to take the time to express yourself in a way that is in accord with your deeper intention. And that, I think, is a model for all of us, that it's not about not having the views. And I mean, in a way, kind of like I think what Joyce is saying, you did, by doing the action, you were saying there's something wrong about this. But the way you handled it was you turned it into an opportunity for someone to wake up, actually. And for you to liberate yourself from your obsessive mind by releasing some energy, but in a way that actually was a door for somebody else then to be able to wake up rather than just to be defensive.
It's Thor as well. It's complete, undivided activity. And I think it's a misreading of these teachings when we hear, you know, like, the great way is not difficult, just don't have any preferences. You know, and then we think, well, okay, I have to try to eliminate my preferences or squash my feelings but it's something about how we cherish and nurture and attach to our preferences and whether we can lighten them enough to hold them sort of lightly, you know. Yeah, listen. Thank you, Kathy.
Likewise, just kind of watching you at the trees as you ended speaking, I just kind of saw in your body the going to that really courageous place of, okay, I just described something that you, just described something that you also witnessed from the place of not attaching to a separate self. And it's really, I watch you kind of look around like, well, it's vulnerable. It's vulnerable not to cling right back to personal views and what we think of as ourselves. But we can experience that unconstructedness and feel the life in it that... it takes a lot of courage to, like Kathy was saying, to commit so much to these vows of practice, to take a step off and like, what's there? So thank you for giving me courage.
Thank you, Liz. I think it's also, you know, just, you know, to go back to what Aria was saying, it's an effort to sort of manage my own suffering too. In a way, you know, I mean, ever since this election that happened 1 year, 24 hours ago, it's, I've sort of adopted this practice of like, okay, there's an outrage ledge here. I need to back away from it. Like, I'm getting really close to the outrage ledge. And then I just got to back away from the outrage ledge. You know, so, you know, it's also about commitment to practice, but it's also about, you know, managing our own suffering in the world. And it goes back to Kathy's point about like, we're called to hear suffering and to see suffering in the biggest possible way, not to neutralize it in some way. I was in Sassine once at City Center, with somebody who, in City Center, if anyone has ever sat in City Center, I mean, San Francisco is just washing up against the walls of that Zendo nonstop, the sirens and the people on the street and everything. And for this whole afternoon, there was a dog who I guess was tied somewhere, just howling in the most abject misery, misery, misery. And, you know, we're sitting. And afterwards, we had a little group that was sitting together. And the woman said, oh, my God, that poor dog. And the whole time I was trying to tell myself, it's just a sound. It's just a sound. It's just a sound. And you know, I said, you know, yeah, it is a sound. But that doesn't mean all sounds are the same. You know, and we can, the suchness of that sound, we can feel that deeply, and there's something transformative about serving as a crucible. It's the activity of Kuan Yin, I think, as a crucible for receiving the cries of the world, and then what are we going to do? Are we going to smack somebody? Smack some sense into them? You know, I have plenty of times that I want to do that, but... And then when I've done it, you know, verbally, but it's not practice. Probably time for one more, if anyone has one. Well, thank you all. Thank you very, very much. Being born blessed, I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I am to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable.